This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The United States is being dragged reluctantly back into the Middle East because of the actions of a terrorist group called ISIS, or as the president refers to them, ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The group has conducted a rampage of atrocities since taking advantage of a power vacuum. They have killed children, enslaved, raped, and forced women into marriage, threatened religious minorities with genocide, urged Muslims throughout the world to kill non-believers, and beheaded several Westerners, including an aid worker and two American journalists. But in a speech earlier this month outlining the U.S. response to ISIL, the president pointed out that that organization is neither a state nor is it Islamic.
No religion condones the killing of innocents, and the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslim. And ISIL is certainly not a state. It was formerly al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq and has taken advantage of sectarian strife and Syria's civil war to gain territory on both sides of the Iraq-Syrian border. It is recognized by no government, nor by the people it subjugates. ISIL is a terrorist organization, pure and simple, and it has no vision other than the slaughter of all who stand in its way.
Around the world, outrage over ISIL's atrocities and the threat they pose has been swift and forceful, but no condemnation carries weight more effectively than that which has been coming from within the Islamic community itself. In early September, the London-based Active Change Foundation, circulating the Twitter hashtag #NotInMyName, sent a message to the terrorists and the world that ISIS does not represent their religion.
The ISIS do not represent Islam or any Muslim.
Because it's totally un-Islamic.
Because they're killing innocent people.
Because you're unjust.
We must all unite together and try to stop this group from damaging Islam and damaging Muslims.
Not in my name.
Because your leader is a liar.
Because your actions do not represent the actions of the rightly guided companions.
Because your caliphate doesn't represent the Ummah.
Because what you're doing is inhumane.
Because you abuse heart and minds.
Because you have no compassion.
Because my religion promotes tolerance for women, and you have no respect for women.
And recently, leaders of Charlotte's Muslim community joined the chorus of those condemning ISIS, reiterating that group's beliefs are not the true picture of Islam, but adding an opinion that the media is ignoring the true picture of their faith and lacks coverage of the good work being done by American Muslims and Muslims throughout Charlotte. So we have invited some of those same leaders to join us for the hour to set the record straight. John Ederer is Imam and Religious Director of the Muslim American Society of Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Welcome. Your Osama Idlibi is President of that organization. Good morning to you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for inviting us.
And Atif Chaudhry is Imam of the Islamic Society of Greater Charlotte. Thank you for joining us as well. Oh,
thank you very much. It's a privilege.
And as we go through the program, you can join our conversation. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we should say, I guess, happy holiday to all Muslims listening this morning on Saturday. It is El-Daha. And what is El-Daha?
Eid al-Adha.
Say it again.
Eid al-Adha.
Easy for you to say. So what is it? What does the holiday commemorate?
So the holiday commemorates and it celebrates Abraham. I'll allow the imams actually to elaborate since that is their...
John?
Yeah, basically it's just going back, walking through the steps of Abraham and Hagar and Ishmael and their sacrifices and their story and their amazing representation as the patriarch and the matriarch of the monotheistic faith.
Okay. All three of you say exactly what President Obama said in that clip we played a moment ago, that ISIS, al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, terrorist groups who speak in the name of Islam do not, in fact, speak in the name of Islam and are anti or non-Islamic. How, then, have they been able to subjugate a religious faith as widespread and as powerfully influential as Islam?
Well, Mike, I'd first like to start by saying I commend WFAE for inviting us here, and this is a great opportunity, and it's a great act of true journalism because, as you mentioned, we Muslims feel that we're not being properly represented in the media, and that this very destructive, abhorrent group is getting all this media play, and we have a lot of great things to offer, and we do a lot of great things. So to answer your question, the problem with ISIS is that they are feeding off of ignorance. Ignorance in the Muslim world is commonplace. The dictatorships and the regimes over there are not interested in building a progressive, growing, developing nation. They're just considering their own power and controlling that status quo. So people raised overseas feel oppressed. And when you're oppressed and when you're ignorant, oftentimes you go to extremes. This is just the nature of the world that surrounds them. And so this unfortunate destruction of Iraq that our government made over the last 10 years led to this vacuum that created this very unfortunate environment where people now are latching onto anything to stand up, and ignorance is thriving, and people are taking the wrong understanding of the religion. And I think many people are just using the religion because it supports their political ideas of taking power and control, as we know the Crusaders did with the Roman Empire. Obviously, Jesus Christ was quite innocent of calling for genocide of Jewish and Muslim people, but they used that that religion to support their need for an empirical force in the world.
Does it bother you that religion has been used historically? And how do you explain that religion has been used historically by Christians, by, I guess, I don't know whether the Jews have participated in this or not, but right now there are sects of Muslims that are participating, or people who would call themselves Muslim who are participating in this. Why is it so easy to co-opt religion?
Because it's easy, and it's something that people can latch onto. They're calling themselves Muslims, and they're using Islamic slogans, they're using terminology, they're using ethos and marketing strategies to recruit new members, and they're utilizing this to feed off of perceived and actual injustices, oppression, tyranny in their societies, and wrap with an Islamic wrapping to make it attractive. This is just a marketing tool, and it's unfortunately something that folks are falling into.
Is part of the marketing tool the term ISIS and ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria or Iraq and the Levant? Is that part of the marketing? Because I think one of you has said that that is part of the problem. We shouldn't be referring to them that way.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the root of it, Mike. When you call the name and the language is part of the strategy of succeeding. So when they call themselves Islamic State, they're trying to develop themselves as something legitimate. And those who accept that terminology are, in fact, associating and being part of the problem. We shouldn't refer to them as ISIS. Maybe we can refer to them as ugly. They're not only, not Islamic and not a state, but they're un-Islamic, which is the complete reverse of being Islam. When we associate a religion with a group like that, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, if they want to claim to be Muslim, fine, they can claim to be Muslim. But to associate the word Islam with them is a disservice to Islam.
It was very difficult for us in the aftermath of 9/11 to come to grips with who these terrorists were and how they wrapped themselves in the envelope of this particular religion, because we don't know enough in the West about Islam. We say that we come from the Judeo-Christian ethic. Islam is not part of that in our vocabulary, but the people in that part of the world, it is their ethic. So tell me, Imam Chaudhry, because you studied for a while, although you grew up in New Jersey, you studied for a while in Pakistan. Explain to me why people in that part of the world who are surrounded by Islam, who were raised in the faith of Islam, latch on to people who are anti-Islamic, even though they call themselves Islamic. Why don't they, people who have been bathed in the faith, understand the difference in the messages?
Exactly like how Imam Yahya said, it's ignorance, but at the same time, it's not every person that's latching onto these people that are misusing the Islamic title or the Islamic faith and bringing people to the most extremist understanding of what the Islamic faith has to offer. So it's, and this is a very vocal minority of people even in Pakistan. So if you're specifically asking about Pakistan and, you know, how they latch onto these people, it's not every person that's latching onto them. These are people that have certain grievances with maybe, you know, foreign or specifically Western foreign policy and problems that they have, that they're using these motivators and this agenda to have people get on politically in the guise of, you know, Islamic backing and legitimacy, like he's saying right now. I mean, for instance, after 9/11, which you just mentioned, there was a poll by done by the Gallup World Poll or something like that, where they did a survey of 35 Muslim countries from and different areas where they have large Muslim populations. So they went from South Africa all the way to Southeast Asia. And they asked them the question whether they thought that what had happened on 9/11 was good. Was it Islamic? Was it something that was justified? And 93% said no. 93% of Muslims throughout the world. So when we say that there are people latching onto them, well, yes, they are, but it's a minority. And the focus, especially in the media, is on this minority that has hijacked the identity of Muslims that are true in their understanding of what Islam really is, which is peace, which is tranquility, which is tolerance, and all these other qualities that we are here to discuss and what that...
But if people who are bathed in the faith in that part of the world can latch on to these outliers, and I think it would spell outliers in this case, L-I-A-R-S, if they latch on to it, how are we in the West to understand what's going on? Because I want to put this back at your feet, because at the press conference you held earlier this month, I think it was this month, at the Charlotte Observer, you took the media to task. You said we're to blame for the general public's perception of these terrorists and their connection to your faith, because you say the opposite is true and the media isn't doing enough to we're portraying it that way, and we're not doing enough to dispel the inaccuracies.
Right.
So if people in that part of the world buy into it...
Hmm. Yeah, I would say feeding off of what Imam Atif has said, that a very small percentage of people actually believe that this is Islam amongst Muslims. And so when we go, if we want to give you your listeners a good lens into how to view this in our reality here in America, the KKK is a historical Christian organization. And there have been historically people involved in the U.S. government who said, David Duke, for example, was a congressman in Louisiana. So there have been many groups here that use Christianity, but we don't hear them being referred to as the Christianist KKK. For example, you have these abortion clinic bombings. You have these cults that exist right now in America, and there are many of them, where 12 and 13-year-old girls are being raped by men who believe Jesus Christ is their guide, and they're amassing followers, and people go to those cults, and people with master's degrees go and they decide to live this lifestyle. Then you have Anders Breivik, who recently in Norway killed 77 people in a terrorist act. And there was a big movement here in America that do not call this terrorism, do not call this Christian terrorism. And so he had a dossier or a manifesto that he made called A European Declaration of Independence, in which he claimed, which all the crosses and things on his book, he claimed to be an international Christian military soldier similar to the Knights Templar. Then you have Eric Prince, who is the CEO of Blackwater, which is a militia group here in America that was hired by our tax dollars to go kill Iraqi and Afghanistan people. And his co-workers have taken him to court saying,
I have to stop you because we have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Magazine. The October issue features breakfast with 43 reasons not to skip this meal again. Subscriptions now available at charlottemagazine.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, composed of 15 leading jazz music soloists under the leadership of director Wynton Marsalis, Tuesday, October 7th at Belk Theater. Tickets available at blumenthalarts.org. We're going to talk about the Charlotte Classic Jazz Festival 2014 tomorrow. It's a way to make jazz more accessible to people in Charlotte. And, of course, as we just said, Wynton Marsalis is part of that. But we start the show with a one-of-a-kind musical called Once. It opens tonight at the Belk. It's a different kind of experience. For starters, you can go up on stage, meet the actors, have a drink at the bar on stage, because it takes place in an Irish pub. And we'll find out more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Apple and Google will encrypt newer phones, blocking access to data by law enforcement. And a Swedish company may take control of the U.S. routing system for phone calls and text messages. New security concerns over access to smartphone data.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Islam, and we're talking about how the media portrays Islam in the West and about these organizations that call themselves Islamic when, in fact, they are the antithesis of Islamic, at least according to the true believers of Islam, of which we have three gathered around our table. Imam Atif Chaudhry is with the Islamic Society of Greater Charlotte. Osama Idlibi, who is the president of the Muslim American Society of Charlotte, and Imam John Ederer, religious director of the Muslim American Society of Charlotte. I had to interrupt you, John, just prior to the break. You were going through a list of organizations with Christian bases, or at least they say they have a Christian basis, but they are not, in fact, Christian, acting in the name of Christ, acting in the name of the faith, nor does the media portray them as Christian.
That is our concern. I just wanted to finish by saying Eric Prince was the CEO and founder of Blackwater, and he was a born-again Catholic, and his coworkers took him to court, uncovering that he envisioned a Christian crusade against Islam and Muslims and intentionally deployed to Iraq certain men who shared his vision of Christian supremacy. And so that Blackwater group was known in the military group as shoot first and ask questions later. And they actually massacred the end of Blackwater as a contract from the United States government to help take ambassadors and so forth and to work in the green zone and so forth, ended when they massacred a whole square of people, of innocent people. So those people in Iraq, they remember that, you see, and then they hear about that, and that feeds their way of thinking. So I just want to clarify that all of these groups say and claim that they're following Christ, and we had this military weapons manufacturing company that was putting biblical verses into the sight scopes of military weapons. Now, this is well documented as well. So there are people who have violent ideas, and they have very extremist ideas that go from many different faiths. And so we don't want to blame Christianity or Islam for that.
Well, let me ask you this, because there are people who pick and choose verses from the Bible to justify a lot of positions, and there are people who would say that they have taken they literally have cherry-picked things that taken out of context, support what they have to say, but put back into context would be the antithesis of what they're trying to say. The same thing is happening with the Quran. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it's happening in a way where, without taking a holistic approach of understanding the Quran, they are cherry-picking, like you say, certain verses which serves their purpose. And their purpose is not religious, it's political. It's so that they can amass this following so that they can achieve their goals.
So let me ask you this, because one of you talked about the ignorance that is widespread in that part of the world, because education is not strong, and that's one of the problems over there. The other problem is that we have highly overeducated people with no jobs. That's the other, and that leads to unrest. But if there's ignorance among the population who would then buy into what these leaders are saying, many of those leaders are clerics or position themselves as clerics. Are they in fact, and are they doing that because they actually believe what they're saying, or are they doing that for their own political power?
The latter. They're one thing I just want to make clear. They're not considered actual legitimate clerics or scholars.
So this fellow who leads ISIS, who's only been seen once in recent memory.
Baghdadi.
Is he not a cleric.
He's not. He has no valid education from any Islamic organization or any Islamic seminary or university or anything that would give legitimacy to his understanding.
So
or his knowledge.
why would the people over there follow him if he? Because many of the people over there are highly devout. They pray five times a day. They go to the mosque. They follow the customs. Why would they see this outlier as legitimate?
The same reason some of these people go follow these cults where some guy is claiming Christ has sent me or I'm the reincarnation of Christ, and they start to talk to him and he seems convincing and he's using Bible verses. Just because our listeners...
But the cults that you're talking about, and there are many, and you are correct about this, and we've left out Jim Jones.
Yeah, that was a big massacre.
But it was a big massacre, but nothing like what is happening with people committing terrorism in the name of Islam. Why?
I would beg to differ with you on that, but I would like to emphasize the point that our listeners don't have access to the scholarly bodies of the Muslim world. I have read the Council of Syrian Scholars, the Council of Iraqi Scholars, the Council of, believe it or not, listeners, Saudi scholars have all written extensive condemnations and refutations point by point, and all of their claim is there is no scholarly basis. There is no scholarly representation. Even if there was going to be a caliph, a rightful, pious Muslim leader of knowledge, then all of the Muslim scholars have to support that person. This guy doesn't have one reputable name in the whole – we're talking about millions. We have 1 billion. So we have millions of scholars around the world. We don't have any of those scholars. You have just a bunch of young men growing long beards, don't know anything about anything. They live in oppression and destruction and chaos, and they're just going to try to take control. This is exactly what's going on.
To support your point of view, the Washington Post reports that in a 2010 Gallup poll, the U.S. in the United States, Muslim Americans were actually less likely than other religious groups to believe that targeting and killing civilians is sometimes justifiable. 11% of Muslim Americans said doing so was sometimes justifiable, while more than a quarter of Protestants and Catholics agreed with the statement.
This is because the second objective of the Islamic law that is hugely misrepresented, people often refer to it as Sharia, is to preserve the sacredness of human life. And there is verses and verses upon verses of the Quran that unless somebody is actually fighting you with a physical force of violent threat to your life, you have no right to attack or kill or put any danger into anybody's life. It's sacred. Life is sacred in Islam.
You're not the first person I've heard say that. And obviously that's a widespread – that's a fundamental,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's a verse of the Quran.
It's a fundamentalist view to hold all life sacred as a Muslim.
So
– you know what's interesting, Mike, too, is that Muslims continue to be the largest victims of terrorism by a wide margin worldwide. If you take a look – a substantial majority of the terrorist acts that take place in Muslim countries, killing or injuring Muslims, and this is according to the State Department's country report on terrorism 2013, which lists the number of attacks by country and number of casualties. The top three in 2013 were Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And so we're talking about human life. And I was born in Syria. And my grandmother still lives in Syria. And in Syria, in the last 3 years alone, 200,000 people have lost their lives. And that is something that is extremely, extremely unfortunate.
So what you're saying is that the victims of all this, the principal victims of all this, are Muslims themselves.
Without a doubt.
Post 9/11, we have lost hundreds upon thousands of people in the Muslim world as a result of back and forth.
And Osama, you said in the Observer press conference that no interpretation of Islam condones the torture and murder of civilians, the destruction of houses of worship, which has happened countless times over there under the hands of ISIL, or the targeting of religious minorities. Then I keep coming back to the same question, and maybe it is because we simply have this block, this cultural divide. Why people in that part of the world who see their mosques being destroyed, who see their fellow Muslims and citizens being killed and tortured and brutally murdered, why they don't rise up against that?
I think they have. Like, for instance, in Syria. In Syria, they have risen, and they've been crying out to the world for the last 3 years. asking the world to help them, asking the world to support them, just even with basic necessities, food, shelter, and just arming them to defend themselves. We're talking about the moderates. And now the moderates see, after, you know, 3 years of torture, of killing, of massacre, nobody's responding.
Isn't that partly because we don't know who to help? We don't know who to trust. We don't want the weapons being given to one group only to find them being used on us five years
later. This is very unfortunate, because when we supported Benghazi and we as Muslims supported the intervention to take out Muammar Gaddafi of the Libyan dictatorship of many decades, then we saw some crazy lunatics rose up and took some of the weapons and then attacked the embassy and killed one of our ambassadors. This is very unfortunate. And so this precedent, unfortunately, and that goes back to the original point, under Gaddafi's regime, most of these regimes use secularism, mm-hmm. right? Syria is a very secular, non-religious land. So those people don't know anything about religion there. As a result of when we say secular, we're talking about freedom of religion here. When they say secular, I mean, put religion away, get like communist, like some sort of removal or marginalization of religion. It's some old, outdated thing. There are many people here who think that, but we still have this beautiful freedom and right that people can promote and live and practice their religion as much as they like. So those people over there in Syria don't even know the religion. So now they're latching onto something to give them confidence to fight back against this tyrannical dictator.
So it would be like a person who is born Catholic but never practices, and then suddenly something comes along socially that seems attractive, and it's called Catholic, and that's a good thing. So maybe I should latch on to that.
Exactly. You have hit it.
Okay. Let me share with you some things that have come across the email, et cetera, while we've been talking. Jarvis emails two questions. Does Islam consider any non-believer, such as a Christian, to be an infidel? And does the Quran say that Muslims are to kill any infidels?
Yeah, obviously, categorically false does the Quran teach to kill non-Muslims. The Quran
In fact, the opposite is true, isn't it?
Yeah. We're actually supposed to protect them. The verse that first talked about fighting back against the decade of tyranny by the polytheist Quraysh against the Prophet Muhammad, it said, permission is given to fight back and defend yourselves. For if God does not give this permission, then people cannot check another set of people. And then the religious minorities will be killed and the synagogues and the churches will be destroyed where God's name is mentioned a lot. And so the Quran refers to Christians and Jews as the people of the book, people who have scripture, and it respects them as people who understand God and have a relationship with based on a valid prophetic teaching.
This the slogan, that's a wrong word, but the motto, I guess, of Islam is there is but one, you do it for me. There is but one God.
There's
no God but God. And that God is the God of Abraham, which is what this holiday on Saturday is all about. And your tradition goes back to the Jewish tradition of Abraham and all of the prophets in that faith that lead up to Jesus, who is, in your view, a prophet. And Muhammad,
very highly regarded prophet.
And Muhammad is the last of the prophets in your point of view.
Yes.
This is something we've talked about before on this program. I just want to put that out there for people who don't know and who have not heard those previous programs.
In terms of the question that killing of non-Muslims and does Islam condone it, there's actually a verse of the Quran where God says that God does not stop you or لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين. God would never stop you, that you do not kill those people that do not fight you. The people, it means in terms of self-defense. So if self-defense is employed in certain situations, then it's allowed. But besides that, God does not stop you from, what is it exactly?
You have to have righteousness, piety, and goodness toward your neighbors, of those people who did not kick you out of your lands and fight you on behalf of your religion. So basically what's being said here is you need to have the highest standard of care. As the Prophet Muhammad said, that the best of you are those who are good to your neighbors and take care of your neighbors. The golden rule is emphasized in various teachings in the Quran and the
So basically God does not stop you from people that do not fight you, and he orders you to do good to these people and be just, and God loves those people that are just, and this justice is not just reserved reserved for Muslims. It's also for non-Muslims. And there's many traditions of the Prophet where he was very adamant in his protection of the non-Muslims, where to the point where he said if they were wronged in terms of their properties, in terms of their self and their integrity, that he will be their advocate on the Day of Judgment. And so there are many very strong worded teachings of the Prophet in terms of protection of non-Muslims, in terms of protection of people that are under the Islamic State in a country where they have to be protected, and not just them, but their churches, not just, and their women, and everything else that goes along with it, which is in complete contradiction of what's happening with ISIS.
Frank emails, as a white Anglo-Saxon, I'm quite aware of how governments have used religion to carry out policy. A modern example is both German and USA and Britain using the churches of the same religion to preach patriotism while killing each other. Brian emails, do your guests consider Wahhabis Muslim?
Yeah, so Wahhabism is basically the Saudi Arabian mentality. And so the Saudi Arabian mentality is very harsh and rigid and very culturally modern Arabian. So if you look at the history of the Muslim world, there was a golden era of flourishing greatness where Muslims were the inventors of chemistry and algebra and trigonometry and modern day surgery and optometry and all of these great things. At the same time, these people were writing books in the religious fields of knowledge, in the theology and the creed and the law and so forth. So there was a huge wealth of flourishing intellectualism within the Muslim world while the European community was going through what they call the Dark Ages. And so Spain was flourishing as a Muslim land. In the last three centuries, Mike, the Muslim world has really been struggling. And so in the last century, there's this movement that came out of Saudi Arabia. You're talking about in the last 100 years. They see all the corruption and all of the bad things in the Muslim world, and they are trying to do something to make it puritanical.
Why for 300 years has the Islamic world been suffering? Has it been at the hands of colonialism? Has it been at the hands of corrupt leaders within that area of the Middle East? What was driving it? Because this predates the Israeli,
right,
the creation of the Israeli state,
right,
by hundreds of years.
Yes. Yeah, so
what's been going on?
But their ideology is something that even predates, you know, the Saudi emergence. I mean, it's, yeah, something that starts from the Kharijis, which was in the time of the third and the fourth caliph of Islam, with the first generation of Muslims. So there was a group of people that went against all the Muslims at that time and did open takfir, which is declaring everyone else besides themselves as apostates. So in their extremist views, if anyone was not with them, they were not Muslim. So that justified their killing of these people who they deemed non-Muslim. And it's that same mentality that has trickled down into these groups that took from that and re-emerged in a way that is more dangerous.
But why? Help me understand why that has happened over and over and over again.
No, I wouldn't say over and over and over again. I think if you look at the Muslim world, we have 1.5 billion people. We have many great things all over the Muslim world going on. You have hundreds of thousands of Muslims all over the Muslim world right now doing amazing relief efforts, leading all of the relief efforts, taking in money from all over the world, sacrificing their lives. I'm not going to praise him, but Osama Idlib's father is a very well accomplished doctor from Panama City, Florida. He has lived in Syria for almost the last few years, giving up everything and putting all of his savings into helping those people over there. And he is not the only guy. There are hundreds of thousands of people like this. Unfortunately, those stories are not being said. We keep hearing this negative death, murder, destruction, doom and gloom all over the media. We really need to start talking. Like, I know one of the listeners, a good friend of mine, John Coppage Henley, is a Methodist pastor here. We went and did Habitat for Humanities last week. Our mosque and his church got together and built a house for people who came from the Congo a couple weeks ago. So that's a good thing.
That's John Ederer. We'll talk more about the good things that get mixed up or lost in the media when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Hickory Museum of Art, hosting the 6th Annual Lake Norman Folk Art Festival, Saturday, October 4th at Sherrill's Ford. Open to the public. Details at hickoryart.org. Apple and Google will encrypt newer phones, blocking access to data by law enforcement. And a Swedish company may take control of the U.S. routing system for phone calls and text messages. So, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Diane Rehm Show. Diane and her guests will talk about new security concerns over access to smartphone data. That's coming up. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we are coming right back.
Hey, it's David Green here. The last car I owned was a navy blue Volkswagen Jetta. It was about 10 years ago, and it was hugely problematic. It had this window problem where sometimes the entire driver's side window would slide down into the door. Not cool when it's cold outside or raining. Crazy to think that even that car could be turned into the programs that I love.
Call 1-866-789-8627
or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Islam and the negative aspect of Islam that seems to take all the headlines versus the good works that are going on that nobody seems to know about. With Atif Chaudhry, he is the imam at the Islamic Society of Greater Charlotte. John Ederer is imam and religious director of the Muslim American Society of Charlotte, where Osama Idlibi, also one of our guests, is the president of that organization. It must be tiring to have to defend yourself and your religion all the time.
It's tiring, but it's important. We have to be able to speak out, Mike. I don't think Muslims are doing enough to speak out against.
Well, that is interesting, because years ago when we were doing a series of these programs in the aftermath of 9/11, a lot of people said, where is the outcry in the Muslim community? We don't hear that. And maybe we're not reporting it. Maybe the media is not shining a spotlight on it. But you say that you folks need to say more?
Absolutely. I mean, it's on both sides. I mean, if you look at the media coverage, it's all negative about Islam. But at the same time, that should feed Muslims and empower them to be able to speak out more. Muslims need to engage more in society. Yeah. Muslims need to reach out to their neighbors. Like, for instance, before I got on this show, I sent out a message to all my neighbors and told them I was going to be on this show for them to listen. And if they had any questions, that I would be more than happy to assist them with that. Muslims need to reach out.
I would agree with Osama in that when it comes down to your average Muslim person here in America, for whatever reason, they're shy or they feel like maybe culturally they are not able to connect with their neighbors. But I do want to reiterate, because my dad, within the year of 2001, where's all the condemnations? CARE, Council of American Islamic Relations, ISNA, Islamic Society of North America, ICNA, the Islamic Circle of North America, EMJA, the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of North America. All of the umbrella bodies of scholars have issued press releases of every single thing that's happened since 9/11, because it's all against our religion. Unfortunately, those press releases do not find their way on any media.
You know, I think that is a valid condemnation, because somebody once asked me, we do all these wonderful things at this school, it's an elementary school. How do we get coverage in the media? And I said, jokingly, set fire to the school. because that will get you on television. The problem is bad news leads. Mm. How do and we are to blame for this, because good news seems soft and gushy, and it doesn't fit in our current news format in the world.
Well, it's not just our news format, Mike. It's our entertainment system. It's all negative. If you look at the movies and the shows, dramas about death and murder and destruction and horror. And unfortunately, our society is taking the wrong route. We need to be positive, moral people.
So use some of the time that we have left to us to talk about some of the good things, some of the things that you would like people to know about your faith, about what your followers, the true believers, are doing in the world today.
Muslims are supposed to serve, Mike. Part of what we believe is that servitude is the key to human liberation. We want to be able, if we don't go out and we are not serving society, then we are not fulfilling our purpose.
The Prophet Muhammad said, the best of you are the most beneficial to those around you.
So some of the things that you're actually doing, you've mentioned a few. There's the Habitat Projects, which many religions participate in and many non-religious people participate in. But there are the relief efforts that are going on in Muslim countries with Muslims from around the world who feel compelled to go back and aid the victims of this violence that is being perpetrated on them by non-believers.
Well, even locally here, the Muslim American Society, we have our own apparatus of taking care of the homeless and feeding them and sending clothes and blankets uptown and going to the urban ministries and these places here. We have a group called Being There that a young man from our community actually reached out with other people in our community and then outreached with the other faith-based people in the community. So Being There has a board of Christian youth leaders, of Jewish people from Temple Bethel, and they all come together and they do stuff for the sake of God.
Now, Osama, you're from Syria.
That's correct.
I have a sneaking suspicion, Atif Chaudhry, that although you grew up in New Jersey, you have a background, a family from another part of the world.
Pakistan.
And you spent time in Pakistan
studying.
John Ederer, you are from Oklahoma.
An Okie.
That's right.
Born and raised.
Where the wind comes blowing down the plain.
Nice.
Or something like that.
Sweeping.
What was sweeping? Thank you very much. So
we learned these things growing up.
Tell me what attracted you to Islam, because I also have a sneaking suspicion that you were not born into the faith.
Right. My family were good, nominally Catholic folks. And in my experience with personal spirituality and seeking truth growing up, I studied comparative religion. And to be honest with you, there wasn't many Muslims in Oklahoma, obviously.
I would think not.
Yeah, growing up. And just as a truth seeker, having my questions and looking, you know, going to the pastor, going to the priest, talking to folks, rabbis and people, when I finally had a chance to read a translation of the Quran that I got at Borders, which is Barnes & Noble now is the common one. Yeah. I just got a translation of the Quran. I wanted to read it. And when I read it, I felt like my theological concerns and philosophical interests that I have embedded in my heart, that God was talking to me and that I was being awakened as a spiritual person.
Now, Jabril Huff, who is also a local person who converted, I think, from being a Methodist, I believe, I could be wrong, had a similar experience. He was going through his personal search. For people who don't understand, and there are a lot of American young men who are being attracted to the wrong side of this and going over there to fight for the terrorists, what's going on there? If Islam says one thing to you,
it's
a good thing.
Yeah.
What is it about Islam that attracts these people to do terrible things from America?
So let me give you some background. Actually, for every one male in America that becomes Muslim, a female chooses Islam. So this claim that Islam is oppressing women, I would say the Saudi culture and their application of their interpretation of Islam, it oppresses women. But those women, they study Islam. And they're not Muslim. And nobody's telling them you have to become Muslim or put on any garb of sorts. And they're choosing Islam. When I read the Quran, I anytime the war came up, I saw it that people are attacking you. You have to, like the famous verse in chapter 2, verse 192 and 193. When the people fight you, you fight back and do not be the aggressor, because God does not love the aggressors. There is no compulsion in religion. I could sit here and go on and on, because I know we don't have time, about verses about the doctrine of just war in Islam. And that is literally not even 1/50th or 1/100th of the Quran. I mean, you're talking about a handful of verses. So the people, when they come to Islam, they are attracted to what is Islam, which is the beauty of a connection with God and understanding prophethood and purpose in life.
Since you studied comparative religions, how would you compare the Quran to the Bible?
I don't want to rub anybody the wrong way.
In terms of what it teaches overall in the broad scheme of
things. Actually,
because you can
cherry
pick the Bible.
Yeah, obviously. And I think any true student of the Bible who studied the verses that talk about war in the Quran would admit that the Bible is much more harsh in those terms in some of the Old Testament verses. But I would say that in comparison, when you talk about the overall morals and values and the concept of the oneness of God, the concept of loving your neighbor as yourself, the concept of the commandments of preserving a healthy, peaceful well-being of society is the exact same. The Bible and the Quran are the exact same.
Chip in Mooresville says, how is it that Islam permits radical imams to preach jihad from a mosque? It seems that there should be more centralized denouncement from Islamic leader hierarchy. I read that Osama bin Laden, was influenced by an after-school teacher, while his classmate is a New York ophthalmologist that saw this wayward matriculation firsthand. Isn't part of the problem, perhaps, that there is no hierarchy?
That is definitely a problem. For someone who came from a Catholic background, I can say that the hierarchy system does give some checks and balances within the community. That being said, we do have an orthodoxy, what people are calling Sunni, which is 88% of the Muslims, about a billion people. There is a well-preserved chain of transmission understanding of legal theory and doctrine and derivation methodologies. It's actually quite amazingly complex in its systematic function. So this jihad that you're hearing about is completely antithesis to all schools of thought of the history of Islam. Jihad is a personal struggle. It is not killing innocent people and attacking people. Jihad is a personal struggle with evil that everybody is doing. It is something that all Muslims hold sacred. It is stopping yourself from lying. It's preserving yourself from lusts. It's stopping yourself from getting angry and responding harshly to people who are annoying you. This is the personal jihad. The social jihad is the police system, the fire department. And then you have the military that is there to defend and protect the people. Those are, as we understand it in the Western term, no different than the Islamic understanding of law.
Well, go ahead, Imam.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Because one of the things that the problem that we have in the West is it's a language. It's a language barrier. It's not just a cultural barrier or a religious barrier. There are terms like Islamist, like jihad, like caliph, like sharia, the conflict between the Sunnis and the Shiites, difficult for us to understand. And the words are scary.
So now right now they're trying to call these people Islamists. This is a big, big problem. What is an artist? It is one who does art. There are good artists and there are bad artists. What is a socialist or an atheist? It is one who doesn't believe in theology or God or religion. There are good atheist people and there are bad atheist people, okay? We cannot say someone who believes in Islam as their system of life is evil and try to make all of the Muslims representative of some very small fringe faction that has nothing to do with what it means to be an Islamist.
Some of the other problems in the West, I think, have to do with the outward signs of being a Muslim. If you're an Hasidic Jew, You look a certain way. You wear certain clothes. You wear your hair a certain way. Women perform. Women act in a certain way. And the same is true of Islam, which is the antithesis of what has happened in the West with regard to how we dress, how we act, etc. And Roland emails, where are the Muslim women? Are they allowed to speak? We just happen to have a panel of men. We have had a panel of Islamic women?
That's interesting you mentioned that, Mike. Something that I'm really proud of with regards to the Muslim American Society here in Charlotte. Three of our board members are women,
okay,
which is something that's unique. We promote women to speak out. We promote women to take an active role. That's what Islam teaches.
So this isn't some modern trying to fit into American thing. The wife of the Prophet, peace be upon him, Aisha, may God be pleased with her, was the senior scholar amongst the companions of the Prophet. When they would differ and argue about a given legal matter, they would go ask her, what does Aisha say about this? And she would clarify, and she would sometimes put her foot down. As a matter of fact, and this might be a little bit tough for people to grasp, but when there arose some major conflict in which some Muslims were actually fighting each other, she led an army against those aggressors who were unjustly starting some problem.
One of you says, and we have a problem in the West, some people have a problem with Christianity and its relationship to science, but that the Quran is completely compatible with science, you say, and further you say that under Islamic law, women were always obliged to work, to own property, to receive an education, to inherit, to vote, to take leadership positions, and otherwise take part in community life. That actually surprised me. Why do we not know this?
Well, this is the Quranic verses in the chapter called The Women. They gave them all these rights 14 centuries ago, long before America and Europe.
And why can't they drive in Saudi Arabia?
So here's what's interesting. Going back to Aisha and that battle, they called it the Battle of the Camel. Why? Because Aisha led the army from her camel that she was driving. Okay, so there are many examples of women riding around on their camels and horses in the time of the Prophet Muhammad with no problem whatsoever to him or any of the other beloved companions who
followed. So the reason that women in Saudi Arabia can't drive is no different really from the Southern Baptist Coalition saying that women need to be subservient to their husbands. It's just a particular belief system that some followers of Islam choose to follow?
Well, I think they actually have a biblical verse for that point.
Okay.
But I would say within our tradition, there is nothing that would say subservient. There is a system in the family, and there's an institutionalization of it. Somebody has to have a final say. So God has given that responsibility. Unfortunately, it's treated in many cultures, Christian and Muslim, as some dictatorial authority and power of subservient relationship, when rather it's just a matter of consultation, and then when it comes down to it, who has the final say?
And I want to point out that we did, in fact, invite two Muslim women to join us on the panel today, but they were not available to be with us today at this hour. So, Chris in Morrisville writes, why is it that when anybody says anything negative or draws a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad, that they end up, he says, end up dying, but at the very least, they have to go into hiding, he said. They are threatened. There is a fatwa put out on them. Why?
Well, I would like to clarify first that we live in a society that is secular and in the West, okay? If you're in a Muslim society that's some sort of theocratic rule where the Prophet Muhammad is revered as the founder of the society's system and so forth in some sort of way, then obviously people would revere the Prophet Muhammad and nobody would do anything like that. So it would be completely abhorrent why anybody would do that. When you choose to live in a Western society, you have to accept the fact that there are people who don't believe and there are people who make jest about belief. And that's their God-given right, that they live in a country where that's their right. And so let them do whatever they want to do and don't allow it to bother you, because it doesn't harm the Prophet, it doesn't harm the religion, it doesn't harm God, it doesn't harm me. So I don't care if anybody writes a character. And I think this goes also back to the whole cultural thing. So we're here in the West, we have a certain attitude and tolerance and understanding that Islam promotes. But in the East, there's this certain rigidity of sticking with, you know, how we feel. So I think that those people, it's just they're just taken off guard and respond.
John Ederer, Osama Idlibi with the Muslim American Society of Charlotte, and Atif Chaudhry, Islamic Society of Greater Charlotte. You don't get to sing today, Osama. I'm sorry. We're out of time, but thank you for the hour.
Charlotte talks with